And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
One more time, coming at you from Los Angeles. This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernis, and coming at you from the Motor City. It's the Motor City Madman, Detroit's very own Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Fantastic. Freezing my... Oh, no. You know what? It's... The weather's above freezing, so I can't say I'm freezing my ass off. I am above freezing my ass off.
We are looking at another 93-degree day here in the City of Angels. And in our own way, Dean, not particularly fun, I must say, because we went from 70-degree weather and low 30s at night to literally the very next day, mid-90s.
The old devil wind came in, did it? The old
Santa Ana's whipped back up again. And as I pointed out, and people don't think about this, right? When they think about the balmy weather in Southern California, but no sooner than the sun goes down, then the temperature drops 25 degrees within an hour, right? And that kind of change, that rapid, doesn't feel healthy ever. And the sudden influx of heat, which is going to go out as soon as it came in. So after this this fall chilly weather, we had a 2-day heat wave followed by cold weather and massive rainstorms. So the sudden dramatic changing of weather patterns is something, you know, living in Los Angeles for more than 30 years, as I have, this is a recent phenomenon.
Well, this is what they're saying everywhere. I mean, moving here, these polar vortexes, these early winters, everyone says, oh, that's so unusual for Michigan. And I'm like, yeah, well, I've been here exactly almost 1 year to the month. And that's the usual Michigan winter experience, it seems.
Now, you will be thrilled to know that your audio levels look beautiful. They look consistent. Everything's coming through fine on this episode 652 of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, which has been changing the way people listen to the internet since May of 2007. And we are packing up, even as you are packing the car in anticipation of a road trip with Patty. And Lilu and Loki, you are driving. What vehicle are you going to be driving all the way from Detroit to Los Angeles next week, Dean, that can contain all four of your outsized personalities?
Yeah, you know, the good people at Hertz have kindly rented us a Chevy Malibu, I think. Or perhaps it's the Subaru. And anyway, yeah, we're hitting the road. We're taking Route 66 pretty much all the way from St. Louis to Amarillo over to Flagstaff, Arizona.
We've all heard the song. We know the names. Tucumcari is an important stop along the way. You know, there's so many derivations of 66 also, by the way, that you can really get lost in exploring. But I can't recommend it enough, going off-road and doing as much of it on the two-lane road as you can, though your animals may not particularly enjoy that, I'll tell you that much. There's a lot of winding switchbacks when you get to Arizona there, and the longest extant stretch of... and when you go through Oatman... which is a ghost town populated entirely by donkeys that'll block your path on in the main town there in the main street and come up to the car. That'll be quite the experience for Lilu.
Wow, that's some off leash experience then for her.
There's no way anyone at Hertz can find this show. So let me ask you: Are you letting them know that you're traveling with animals, specifically a cat?
Well, we are taking our hammock, our dog hammock that fits in the back seat, so all the hairs and muddy paws are contained
Did you hear my part about the cat? Did you let them know about the cat? Most rental agreements, as I have understood it, prevent cats.
Why? That makes no sense. The cat's in the carrier. The cat stays in the carrier bag the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll last an hour and a half.
No, we've already driven numerous hours with the cat.
What about the litter box?
We stop. We take stops and we have a tent.
Yeah, this is – oh, my goodness. This is – I can't wait for cut to the anger and the frustration as week two of this road trip goes on. All right. No, very quickly, you got to let the cat just out of the bag and have free run of the car to deal with business whenever it wants to deal with business, which means litter everywhere. And the good people at Hertz are just going to have to get used to that. But we're plugging them for free on this episode 652 of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And why, Dean, am I emphasizing the number of this episode?
Because it's a Chinese New Year coming up and we're coinciding with the I don't know. Why are we doing that?
Because after this week, we roll the count back to one. We're going back to one because on Monday, December 2nd, live at 9 p.m. Eastern time, season two of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour finally gets underway after more than 12 and a half years. We're ready to begin season two.
Yeah.
On the
technical issues.
On the Odyssey Radio Network every Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern, the show that has been changing the way you listen to the internet will be live. It'll be airing live. It'll be streaming live. iHeartRadio. A whole manner of platforms, and in the hours thereafter, it will become available in podcast form.
Ah, how exciting.
Is it? We'll find out. Tune in to find out if it's exciting, and if so, how exciting, and also to make sure that Dean and Patty and Lilu and Loki all made it safely to the City of Angels for their winter holiday excursion.
Well, now you got me scared of like how I thought this was going to be a breeze.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, my God. You're traveling with it. No, never think it's going to be a breeze. Oh, my God. Never. Yeah. That's the trap, man. You've got to be on full alert. You go on any road trip, especially Route 66. Fortunately, you won't be traveling with California plates. That helps.
Why does that help?
Sometimes I'm not going to mention states by name, but let's just say hypothetically Arkansas and Arizona. Sometimes people with guns decide to chase you out of the state because of the license plate. No, there's a lot of fucking morons in red state America.
But there's everywhere.
No, there absolutely is. But in this particular instance, there are assumptions that are made. California is crazy because not only is it the most populous state, obviously, in the nation, but it's the most growing in terms of population. We don't have places to put these people anymore, and yet rapidly from the rest of the country, people still gravitate towards California. And yet there's resentment towards California, and there's resentment towards it like we're the home, quote unquote, of the resistance or whatever, right? And yet it is the state that holds the most, for example, Trump supporters of any state. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't outnumbered by, for example, Hillary supporters in the last election, but it's such a huge population base that it also means that it's a huge population base for anyone, for all types. And of course, you know, California, I think when people think of California, they automatically think of Los Angeles. God knows people in Los Angeles do. But it is quite a diverse state geographically, economically, politically, in all ways, in terms of religion, it is a diverse state. The Bible Belt is nowhere more in evidence than in Central California, for crying out loud, which is the fastest growing population base in this state. The evangelical movement started in Southern California, for crying out loud. So
I know.
People, don't paint all of California with one particular brush. And please give safe harbor to Dean and Patty, Lilu and Loki.
Thanks.
That's what I'm saying.
That's nice.
I myself, while you're doing that road trip out here, now you're gonna be out here before Thanksgiving, right?
That's sort of the plan, yeah.
And I'm gonna be spending Thanksgiving on the Delta in Mississippi. And prior to that, I'm gonna be in Oxford, Mississippi, and on my birthday, which is 1 week from today.
Happy birthday!
I will be in Memphis. At the Peabody Hotel, taking pictures and recording audio of
recording an album.
No, of the Ducks, of the show that the Ducks put on. You had never heard of this, and you know, a couple times a day, the Ducks come down from their penthouse apartment in their elevator, and they let themselves out, and they put on a show in the lobby, and then they go back up to their penthouse. So yeah. I'll be recording. That's a big deal, and I'll be recording that for you. And then I will be going to the Civil Rights Museum, where I have never been, and I've always wanted to go. And long before it was a Civil Rights Museum, when I was a little boy, I actually got to see the hotel, because it was the hotel where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And I got to see it as a little boy, but I've never seen it as the Civil Rights Museum. So I cannot wait for that. How I wanted to spend my birthday. And that is what I will be doing. And it's one of the reasons why we will not do a show next week. We're taking a much-needed week off so that we can recharge the batteries and get ready for the launch of Season 2.
Right. And I apparently will be fighting a cat in a car. I didn't realize.
And I know as the excitement builds surrounding the launch of Season 2, people are asking themselves, when will this particular episode begin?
That's a great question. Let it begin now.
Yeah, and let's start with a live event of the week.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
As promised, I attended a Veterans Day performance of Rant and Rave at Rogue Machine, and again was reminded that there may not be a better experience in all of Southern California than attending these almost monthly live storytelling shows. I mentioned Assassination. The theme of their next one in December is Assassination.
Wow.
Interestingly enough.
How ironic.
I honestly, hand to God, don't know whether this is just rumor or whether it has been confirmed, but there is a rumor that my wife is participating in the show next month. But I don't know. I don't have confirmation of that. The invitation was given, and... but I don't know if it was formally accepted because all I've seen is casual wear. So I don't know about the former. That we're working, we're clearing out the desk, getting rid of all the old corny jokes, because we have we have all new corny jokes to start. Oh my God, I went to Turlock, of course, week before last for some family mishigas, and Lily came up and joined me at one point. Thank God. Saved my sanity. But she and I took my dad to the barber shop. And this is one of his big things. He loves going to the barber shop. And he was sitting there with Lil. And it was actually quite charming. All the years that I'd been going up there and I would take him for his barber, I'd never gone in. And it's cool because it's an old school barbershop. I mean, it like vintage old chairs and everything, you know, the Art Deco design and
but without the hipster irony. Exactly.
Exactly.
It's been there like that since the 60s.
Exactly. At least. Yeah. Very true. And maybe even this barber has been there since the 60s. Right. But my dad, you know, pointed out probably the obvious irony of him being in a barbershop, which is, you know, he's got about the same amount of hair as I do, you know? And he said to Lily, you know, it's probably funny to you that I need to go to the barber. You know, I mean, I remember when I came in here and the barber first told me, you know, you really have thinning hair. And I told him, well, good. Who wants fat hair?
brought to you by
but wait, there's a part two. The barber told me how I could actually save my hair and gave me a little cigar box.
And then how to avoid falling hair, you jump out of the way. There's a thousand of them.
My dad always claimed to have a million of them all the time I was growing up. Like, he would always say, I got a million of them. I got a million of them. And I would ask, then why do I hear the same two or three over and over again, over and over again? So this time I prompted him and I said, Dad, how many of those do you have? And he goes, I don't know. I go, you got a million of them. He said, what? He said, don't you have a million of them? I don't know what you're talking about.
Great. I used to have a million of them.
Was not the live event of the week. The live event of the week was Rant and Rave at Rogue Machine. It was a Veterans Day themed one. All the performers were, and by the way, these are not these Rant and Rave, these storytelling shows. What's spectacular is how well produced they are. It's not like you can just say, we're doing a storytelling show, first come, first serve, sign up, here's the theme, do it, and it's going to be good. I mean, these producers working, I'm imagining, for little or no money on this. Not only do they personally invite speakers, often taking a chance on first-time speakers, and these are not all actors, these are not all writers, these are not all producers, these are people from different walks, and often with no experience even with public speaking, and they weave them in such a way that it completely confirms my faith, my fervent belief in the idea that the best work can be done when you combine a skilled veteran professionals with the untrained and the amateur. It doesn't mean automatically that the best work will come. It's just that combination, when it works, works beyond imagination.
Right.
And you know this from your improv shows, right?
Absolutely, yeah. When you prompt people who've never been on stage, there's an energy. It's either nervousness, maybe stage fright, but that energy's contained and often expressed in a delightful way.
Yeah, and earnestness and even fear. Even healthy fear, right?
Right.
So, the producers work with the people in terms of the writing of their material. From my own personal experience, they in no way try to write for you. They want you to tell the story that you are drawn to write. And they keep asking you, are you sure this is the story that, and not this part here? Because what we keep reading is that your emotion is going towards this part over here. They're really attuned to trying to pull out what it is that you want to tell, but might be afraid to tell. Even as a trained professional, right? Because we want to gravitate towards maybe something emotionally, but on the other hand, all of our professional training is going towards, but this is the crowd pleaser over here.
Right.
Yeah, right. Are you sure you want to do? And Dean, the order of these things, the order of these speakers, I think there were six or seven that night. It's so incredible how they architecturally build level after level. This energetic structure gets built up, and it is just a spectacular thing to be a part of as a performer and as an audience member. Nobody comes away from these things unchanged, and no one will ever forget them. And our friend Tucker Smallwood was the final speaker that night. And it was as incredible as you would think. It drew on his own experiences. It also gave him an opportunity to do what he clearly is moved to do at this point in his life, which is to embrace his madness. Our friend Tucker is going nuts on stage these days. and he also took to task, in no uncertain terms, people's innate acceptance that what is called for when meeting a veteran these days is to thank them for their service. He smacked that idea down, calling it the limp dick expression of gratitude. Thank you for your service. He said, no shit. Thank you for your service when talking to a veteran of combat is a given.
Right.
It's the least that everyone can do. We already expect it. You're not special. That it doesn't mean anything. And he offered a counter that if you are meeting a combat veteran, what you want to say to them is, welcome home. Because no matter when they served and what war they were in and where that combat was, every day is a challenge to feel home.
Right.
Pretty powerful.
That's
stuff.
Amazing.
Huh? Pretty powerful. Yeah.
That is really good.
All right.
Okay.
So maybe
now that's what you say instead. Welcome home.
Maybe when you're here in December, you might get to see one of these shows.
I might.
About assassination. I mean, I think there will be every opportunity for you to share your personal theory about the JFK assassination.
Really? I'm going to do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, sure. I bring it up every time I can.
You do. Okay.
All right. Well, that's a wonderful segue to our final celebrity deaths of season one.
Wow.
Celebrity deaths.
We have a couple here. One is a beloved cult actress, Virginia Leith. Is it Leith or Leith? Is it Leith? It could be any L-E-I-T-H. I've never known this. I've always seen the name, but I don't know. How do you pronounce the name of the actress who starred in the cult classic The Brain That Wouldn't Die, Dean?
Oh.
Is it Virginia Leith, Virginia Leith, Virginia Leith? What is it?
Great question. I'm going to say Leith.
Okay. Virginia starred in that low-budget sci-fi horror film, which became a favorite, right, on the television show Mystery Science Theater 3000.
I think that's what revived it, actually.
Yeah. And now people watch that that movie a lot. But how she started, she's got some fascinating claims to fame. And I guess that's why I wanted to talk about her. She was a model who started acting in their early 50s. Her first starring role was in Fear and Desire. Does that title automatically leap to mind for you, Dean? Fear and Desire. Sounds almost like a film noir, right?
Right.
But it's a war film.
Oh.
And it was the first film by Stanley Kubrick.
What? You're kidding.
Virginia?
I thought I'd seen every Stanley Kubrick film there is.
No, that one's really hard to see, though. I can get you a copy of that. But he himself wanted that available once he became successful.
Right. In fact, now that you say it, I think I saw clips of it from that Kubrick exhibit at LACMA.
Photos, not... I don't think clip, maybe clip, but remember they did not show it out of his wishes, out of his personal wishes.
That's right.
But anyway, so she stars in that. She also featured opposite Robert Wagner in the classic film noir, A Kiss Before Dying. That's one of the greats. So, you know, you've got Fear and Desire. You got Kiss Before Dying. You've got A Brain That Wouldn't Die. I mean, these three films are, for a variety of reasons, right? Very different reasons. These are indelible milestones cinematically.
Yeah, for sure.
She took a break from acting and returned later in life and guest starred on many TV series in the 70s. This is how I first knew her. I mean, she was, if you had a police drama, you had her guest star on it. Starsky and Hutch and Beretta, just to name a couple.
Wow. I love that.
94 years old. All right. Dean, here's a little trivia. Little trivia question for you. Who was Maria Perego? Or Perego? Maria Perego, let's say. Who was she?
Let me think. I'm going to say in the music industry.
Oh, that's lovely. I mean, because it does kind of trip off the tongue. 95-year-old Maria Perego died. She was an Italian puppeteer. And I know what you're saying. You're saying, Phil, another Italian puppeteer? Really?
How many? We talk about that all the time, Italian puppeteering.
If I were almost as many times as we talk about young New Mexican puppeteers, but if I were to mention the name Topo Gigio, would that mean something to you, Dean?
Of course. Topo Gigio is the adorable black and white. I seem to see it in black and white.
Well, because exactly because it became famous on the Ed Sullivan show. It was a 10-inch tall mouse that was a combination of puppet and marionette. It appeared on the show dozens of times from the 1960s through the show's finale in 1971, and she created Topo Gigio. Maria Perego created it and was one of two or three puppeteers required to control Topo Gigio's movements. That's how detailed this was as puppet and marionette, that this little 10-inch tall mouse needed up to three different handlers to make the moves. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
And Topo Gigio was really cool in that you could rarely see the puppeteers. Right. They were always draped in black velvet to disappear into the background.
Well, and that's what I'm thinking. When I think of the image of Topo Gigio, there's no handlers. And even to say it's marionette and puppet mix only now makes me go, oh, yeah, I could see that in its movements. But I didn't realize that until now.
Perego had been a puppeteer for several years when she created Topo Gigio in 1959. She had discovered that sponge material was ideal for puppet creations after seeing a Christmas tree made from green sponge in a shop window. And as we said, though small, this puppet that she made was so intricate that the result was an agile character that could skip around, turn cartwheels, and even had facial expressions.
Wow.
And she continued working with Topo Gigio throughout her whole life. I do remember Topo Gigio appearing on other shows, but reportedly at the time of her death, Miss Perrigo was planning a new sketch with the little mouse during the final months of her life. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Creativity, it goes on for your entire life.
So that we with that, we get to close up the Chill Pack Morgue for a couple of weeks until we reopen it for the launch of season two. And by the way, as my voice cracks, so many of the segments that you love on this show, that you tolerate, and that you wonder what happened to, things like Wing Nut of the Week, will be present in season two. And when we relaunch on December 2nd, we plan a starter sampler of a show where we reset our most beloved topics and we use as illustration topics that we have had on the burner for a while and have not been. Maybe we've hinted at them. Maybe we've discussed them a little bit. But for the most part, we've been saving the good stuff for the launch of season two. And this is just really getting, like I said, we're clearing the desks.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to pack this up and move it. We don't want to move this. There's not enough room in the car with Lulu in a hammock. So we might as well say this on the final show.
Yeah, for sure. Now you're making me all freaked out about this car trip. I was looking forward to it.
All right, let me give you something else to freak out about. You know, we were talking about how the weather is changing so dramatically everywhere. And this is a part of the world that you love, if I remember correctly. I was really struck by the fact that St. Mark's Square in Venice is closed.
Yes. Yes. Now, of course, I don't know. Have you been there before?
I have not. And I'll be honest with you, the smell has always kind of frightened me.
Like the
what?
Smell.
Yeah, like I don't know what that town would smell like with all those ancient canals and stuff. I.
Well, you know, they don't dump their sewage in there anymore.
Anymore. Okay, well, that's good. Well, you say that, and yet, of course, now here we are. St. Mark's Square is closed, and it being closed is going to quickly become a permanent reality.
Yeah, for sure. And this is the very reason we went was specifically to go to places that we knew with the rising seas would become untouristable. The Maldives, islands, Venice, a few other places that you know specifically that high water was going to affect it. So we went there New Year's Eve. I guess that was, 2010? And even then, there was a high tide. There's pictures of me ankle deep walking through St. Mark's Square. There's, already... a lot of it was going underwater, and they were building since 2003 these giant valve gates, similar to what was on the Thames, to prevent high tide coming in. They were supposed to be these hydraulic gates that stopped water from inundating the entire island of Venice, and that's still under construction since 2003. Plagued with scandals, cost overruns, delays, all sorts of things. So time was of the essence, and I think that time has passed.
Oh, that's depressing.
I know.
That's depressing.
Isn't that depressing? And I'll depress you even more. With Bertolucci as the corrupt prime minister of the time,
Bertolucci.
No, Bertolucci?
Bertolucci's the corrupt
Bertolucci's
filmmaker.
The film director.
He's the corrupt film director. Yeah.
Berlusconi.
Berlusconi.
During that time, a lot of the Venice stonework was removed and replaced with concrete replicas, and those can handle salt water. They start deteriorating. So much of Venice that could have survived under salt water for an indefinite amount of time will now, if the water remains high, will just start eroding away because many restaurants and wealthy renovation people have wanted the original stonework from Venice, and the city was more than happy, or certain corrupt officials were more than happy to take up historic pieces of rock and stonework and pavement that had been there since the 11th century, ship it off for a price, and then just put down a concrete replica that in no way will survive the elements. To bum you out even more, there's that.
Well, there was a documentary here about Los Angeles that was made late 80s, right around like 1990. And it was hosted by the great L.A. newsman Ralph Story. And it was so successful that they did a follow-up to it. And it was called Things That Aren't Here Anymore. And then the sequel was More Things That Aren't Here Anymore. Sadly, Ralph's story is one of those things now that is no longer here anymore. You know, that was just a bummer about this city, right? Just one city, things that aren't here anymore for a variety of reasons. And I've often thought that that's the travel show that I would want to produce. And I wanted, if it was Americana, I wanted Charles Phoenix to be either the host or the co-host, and I've talked to him about this, but it would be things that aren't here anymore and a few things that are, so that you balance the depressing of this is gone with, hey, but this is still here, let's make sure that it stays.
Right.
And they could be probably, right, thematically linked in some way. Like maybe if it was a global thing of like, you know, we're talking about Venice or the Maldives, maybe another place that is or would be threatened by similar circumstances were it not for cunning, dogged foresight and determination.
Right, right. That's very few and far places that I can think of. You know, the only thing that comes to mind at the moment is
the Chilpack Studios, where we have built a 60-foot seawall.
Yeah, a 60-foot seawall. See, but that's even a thing too, because the water comes up from underneath. So regardless of how high you build a wall, if your aquifer, if your ground beneath you is porous like all of Florida, or perhaps just all soil based, there's no amount of wall that will prevent your foundation from getting completely waterlogged and your walls sinking into that. So good luck. And
good luck on that. Well, that's a preview of our new segment on the Odyssey Radio Network, Dean Haglund's Home Building Tips.
That's right. Good luck on that. Oh, my gosh.
It's tool time with Dean Haglund. All right. Look, we got a bunch of movies to discuss. And because when we rejoin the audience, it's going to be December, which means we are already into the season of self-congratulations. So much of our focus on movies for those first few shows are going to be the awards season. The best films of the year, because we're going to have to prep for our best of the year. But even before that, quite frankly, we're going to have to do a best of the decade show. So this is going to be our focus. So let's clear the deck of a whole handful of movies, shall we? I went and saw this horror film from Robert Eggers, director Robert Eggers, his follow-up to the fantastic horror movie The Witch from a couple years ago. And The Witch was really, you know, has been hailed as one of the great films of the decade, even though when it came out, oh my God, it was hated by audiences. And it was hated by audiences because it didn't match the marketing. The distributor, A24, I think it was, which you know I'm a big fan of.
Big fan.
They knew they had a great movie on their hands, but they didn't market the movie they had. And the audience was angry about that.
Right.
And that was an important lesson, right?
Yeah.
But I had a very similar feeling about his follow-up, The Lighthouse. And this stars Robert Pattinson, Willem Dafoe. It's a two-character piece. Two men working a remote lighthouse on a rocky shore somewhere on an island in the middle of a storm.
Right, shot black and white.
Okay. Not only shot in black and white 35 millimeter, but Dean, it's shot damn near 1:1 aspect ratio. For people who don't know, the standard aspect ratio these days is 16:9 or 1.78. That means 1.78 to 1. 16:9. That is the aspect ratio of your flat screen televisions. That's right. What most movies, therefore, are now projected at. Very close to the 35 millimeter native aspect ratio of 1.85 to 1, which most of us grew up with in movies. Now,
right.
Most of us grew up on television before flat screens with a 1:3:3 aspect ratio. So your width was a third greater than your height, right? Okay.
Right.
And that was created for television because it matched what movies' aspect ratios used to be during the golden age of Hollywood.
Right. Before CinemaScope and 70 millimeter.
Which were a reaction to television. So television comes along and says, well, we'll match a movie's aspect ratio. People are used to watching this aspect ratio of a screen. So then movies said, well, we need to go wider. We need to change the presentation so that it's an utterly different feel from TV. Okay.
Right.
But during the silent era, the aspect ratio was different. It was 1.19 to 1, which is what Eggers shot The Lighthouse in. It's the silent film aspect ratio. So that is fascinating right there.
Right. Taking a page from Guy Madden, Winnipeg's own.
35 millimeter black and white, as I said. And one of the reasons is because the name of the movie is The Lighthouse. And they filmed it in an actual location with a 70-foot tall lighthouse. And if you are going to name your movie The Lighthouse, the director believed, the lighthouse should be a character in that movie.
Sure.
And so even in the close-ups of his characters, his human characters, out and about on the rocky cliffs of that tiny little island, these are close-ups of his actors, and the complete 70 feet of the lighthouse itself can be seen in all these shots looming over.
Wow. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you went to see this at an IMAX theater.
IMAX, and I ran into a friend who is the projectionist, the technical director for all of A24, and he actually reserved a seat for me in the row where he needed me to see this movie. And he had seen it because he's projected it so many times for different award screenings. And he said, this is where you have to see it. I've seen this movie so many times, and I never enjoy it more than when I'm seeing it on IMAX. Now, it does not fill the IMAX screen. You know, it's not been treated for the IMAX process. But think about this. Because of the 1.19 aspect ratio, if you go to see it in, like, a multiplex, which is how, you know, people usually see it, this is a movie that doesn't fill up the whole screen. Not by a long shot. Not only does it, of course, leave most of the width blacked out, but it doesn't even fill up the screen in terms of height. So you're going into the movie theater to watch a little tiny square on screen. But in IMAX, which is a more square presentation, the full height of that movie can therefore be appreciated.
Ah, that's super cool.
And so I'm immersed in that, which was great fun. And really the way to see it, because visually there is some photography in this. I mean, images that really, we talk about mise en scène a little bit, right? Because we love the French and we love to be pompous. But this is your opening frame of a shot. And the idea is you know everything that is going on psychologically, emotionally, within this story, based on the opening frame, like a still painting, right? A still life. You know, based on what's in there, if you're in the hand of a masterful storyteller. And Eggers is one of these. And so these opening palettes of these shots are breathtaking, Dean. The composition, the contrast, the psychological depth to these things. It's wonderful, and it really is the great way to see the movie if you think of it as seeing a series of paintings, of filmed paintings.
Lovely. Fantastic.
Where it falls apart is as movie.
They're right. And chances are, if I concentrated too much on the series of paintings, I didn't really think about the story enough. Is that correct?
Well, or you thought too much about it. This is a movie that really feels like it's lived in the head of its creator way too long and way too much. People are coming out of it going, what the hell did that mean? What did it mean? You know, like, it was so weird, but I guess it was okay. And these are people in the industry saying shit like this. But I didn't think it was particularly hard to decipher in terms of what it's about. My question is, so the fuck what afterwards?
Did not resonate?
No, it really doesn't. There's a lot of ideas behind it. It is an interesting companion, like I said, and an interesting follow-up to The Witch. But sophomore movies are tough, man. And sometimes they exceed the quality of the first movies for some filmmakers. But that's often rare, especially when the filmmaker's first movie was great. And
right.
I am reminded of Steven Soderbergh following up Sex, Lies, and Videotape with Kafka. Now, I liked the movie Kafka a great deal, but really, Kafka exceeded Sex, Lies, and Videotapes visually in terms of the style and the approach. But in terms of a connection to why did you tell this story, the life that's beating beneath the construct, it was a poor follow-up in that regard. It lacked the juice. It lacked the impulse that gives it life. And ultimately, Lighthouse, you're aware of the ideas behind it, but not that kind of animating impulse.
Sad. That's sad, because I watched the trailer immediately after last week's show to go look at it, and it seemed like it had potential. There was lots of interesting, like you said, graphic elements to it, but also you felt with the trailer that they were stretching for story.
Stretching for story. Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Guy Maddin. I think Guy Maddin is a big influence on this film. And yet, ultimately, it doesn't have the courage of its conviction in regard.
That's the Guy Maddin thing. He sticks to that whatever, regardless of how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, I mean, much like David Lynch. And yet the idea that you would love Guy Maddin and revile David Lynch is still a head scratcher for literally everyone else on this planet. But okay. So that's The Lighthouse. I also saw, I think it comes out maybe day before Thanksgiving, Mariel Heller's new one, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And this is being referred to as the Mr. Rogers movie.
Right.
Though significantly, Mr. Rogers is a supporting character in this film. And it's loosely based on the real life article written about Mr. Rogers in the Hero issue of Esquire and the process of writing that piece that the investigative journalist who was assigned it went through during that process. And as such, it's a pretty darn interesting way to approach a biopic then.
Right.
And Matthew Rhys, who I guess is one of the stars, I'm thinking of Games of Thrones, a show that I don't watch, so I'm not familiar with his work. He plays the journalist, and Chris Cooper plays his estranged father. That's excellent casting. The two men look alike. Tom Hanks is delightful. He's Tom Hanks, for crying out loud. Right. He's doing a really nice version of the voice of Mr. Rogers. And what I appreciate about it is he's playing someone with a lot of anger, you know, that is being worked through, right? It's a very interesting choice, and I think very truthful that, you know, Mr. Rogers, to live the life that he did, to be as tireless as he was, and to die of stomach cancer the way that he did, and as we know from the documentary, to feel as he did about his own failures to make a difference.
Right. I know.
This is a man that was motivated, that had passion, that was driven, that had real anger. He also had a commitment to not only talk the talk, but walk the walk, which is you don't express through that anger. You use that anger. You harness it. You channel it.
Right.
And that's the really important element of what Tom Hanks brings to this. It's a very good performance. He embodies that. Do I ever see Mr. Rogers? No. Do I get a feel for Mr. Rogers? Yes. It's being called the movie we need right now. Maybe. I mean, I think we needed that documentary when it came out.
Right.
My God, a reminder that, oh, this is what Republicans used to be?
I know.
Because Mr. Rogers was a famous, you know, and devoted supporter of the Republican Party.
Yeah,
I know. And so when that came out, yeah, that was really important. That was a movie that we needed. This coming so close on the heels of that, I feel like it's a little too soon. And honestly, right, it might have been better to save this for late October of next year, leading up to the election.
Oh.
During the election season.
As a reminder.
As a reminder of what we were, of what we're capable of, but also a reminder of, look, whatever happens, people, look at how much we have in common and how we all start from the same place. You know, as children, of needing to feel seen and needing to feel heard and needing to learn that what we feel is okay, always okay, and that we can choose to learn healthy and productive ways to express all that we are feeling.
Wow. I need to see this.
And Mariel Heller is a wonderful director, of course, someone that we championed going back when we used to go through the female-directed movies that everyone needs to see.
Right.
Is it up to the level of her Can You Ever Forgive Me, another based on real life movie? About Lee Israel, the biographer Lee Israel, who, of course, gained great financial success fraudulently creating famous letters and materials.
Right.
You know, that movie was spectacular. And this does not live up to that.
Right.
That said, it's a very, very well-directed movie.
Okay.
And one of the things that they do, a conceit that they do that is so nice, is that even though Mr. Rogers himself is a supporting actor in this piece, it is largely set in his world of imagination. And I'm forgetting the name of that realm off the top of my head. But
right.
Make-believe land? Is that what, I forget what it's called.
Something. Yes.
So you'll appreciate some of the conceit they did, especially in terms of the production design and things like that.
Oh, well, now I can't wait.
A couple other films that are award hopefuls, one of which has kind of come and gone in theaters, and one of which is still to come. I saw a while back, I saw Judy. And this is the biopic, the Stan and Ollie biopic of Judy Garland movies. And I say it because it, again, is about a performer trying to reclaim past success by doing a UK tour.
Ah, right. Same storyline.
And this was a series of dates at Toast of the Town that Judy Garland did shortly before her death. And... boy, these kind of biopics can be, for some people, particularly satisfying, even when they never, ever approach what you would call art. Biopics are to cinema writ large what Star Trek V... The Final Frontier was to Star Trek movies. Oddly satisfying on emotional levels, but never particularly what we would consider good. And
right.
So I think too much to be said about it is a waste of time. Renee Zellweger often disappears into the role, and it is a very touching performance from her. And a reminder of all the things that Renee Zellweger had to offer. One of these actors that, boy, were she born in a different era? What a significant body of work we might have had. Not that she hasn't had a significant body of work, but I'm thinking in terms of musicals, right? I mean,
and she can belt the tune.
Well, I mean, this is the Star of Chicago, for crying out loud. And, but also just her harnessing her own vulnerabilities and her own frailties, or perceived or imagined, and bearing them for purpose of this, it is a very touching performance, and will be one that I'm sure is remembered at award time, at least with a nomination.
Right. Normally these things get nominated when you are nailing a historical figure.
Or even when you're not. Even when you're ridiculously awful, giving one of the worst performances in all of cinematic history. Sure, Rami Malek, here's your Oscar.
Boom! Pow!
I will say this, and anyone who's seen the movie will know what I'm talking about. This movie ends with what I think is the nightclub equivalent of the slow clap.
Oh no.
Yeah. Yeah, they pull out basically a slow clap ending. It's that cliched, that tortured, that awful. And yet again, for certain people, those that enjoy Hallmark movies, I imagine, oddly satisfying. So that was Judy. Another award hopeful that'll be coming out is another true life story about attorney Brian Stevenson, who took the case of Walter McMillan. Now, Brian Stevenson, really made the Poverty Law Center, the Poverty Justice Initiative. I forget the name of the organization, but it's really made this a major player. And it's about its origins, really, as a major player, especially where death penalty cases were concerned, when Brian Stevenson took the case of Walter McMillan, a man who, it turns out, was wrongfully imprisoned for the murder of a white woman there in the South. And playing Brian Stevenson is the terrific movie star, every bit of movie star, Michael B. Jordan. Someone who I see pushing against his limitations in this film, who seems to feel the importance of what he's doing so profoundly that I feel an actor struggling with this.
Whoa.
And that's not to say that he's not a great actor and that he won't push beyond those limitations. But you will see from time to time great actors doing that in movies. I think we saw that in the 90s with Tom Cruise occasionally, right? There are moments when you take on a role and you really feel the actor pushing and shoving against their own limitations because they feel what they're doing is so important that they got to do it all. And they lose sight of that faith of, I'm enough.
I am enough.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, particularly if the director or the writers or everybody around the production going, this is such an important movie. Such a story has to be told. We have to do it justice to the reality of the thing and about the blue. When you get all of that psychic weight put on you to then try and have it a character and do your basic acting work with all of that gravity around it, it is hard for sure.
The opposite end of the spectrum is Jamie Foxx. And no matter how many times you see Jamie Foxx do incredible work, right, it still almost sneaks up on you. I mean, think of the performances in great movies this guy has done. Django in Django Unchained, right? Obviously, yeah. His Oscar in Ray as Ray Charles. But what about Collateral, speaking of Tom Cruise?
Collateral.
What a range of performances those are alone, for God's sakes. Yeah. And then he hits you with this, where he plays Walter McMillan, the man who's been wrongfully imprisoned. Dear God, with the exception of one scene when he's released at the end, you never see Jamie Foxx. It is an incredible performance. And I swear to God, I can pick out the moment in the take where you do see Jamie Foxx, where you literally see Jamie Foxx go, oh, I should redo this. Can we do another take?
But it is
such a spectacular, it is so moving, this performance by him, almost otherworldly. And it's a mixed bag in a movie like this, often. Like you said, when everybody is taken by how important it is, and that's why they're doing it.
Right.
Brie Larson is there as Brian Stevenson's assistant. And probably in some way this movie gets bankrolled, sadly, because Brie Larson has said yes to it. It is, by the way, from a director, Destin Daniel Cretton, who did one of the best movies of the decade, did a movie called Short Term 12, which launches Brie Larson as a movie star, which launches Michael B. Jordan. So, you know, he's worked with these people before, so it's great that he's working with them again. But Brie Larson is miscast because, well, one, she's not from the South, and we're all tired of the Southern accent that everybody puts on. But also, it's Brie Larson. It's a little bit of a distraction. You know, give me someone real. But, of course, they needed Brie Larson to get the financing. But I really want to be immersed in the reality of this, the way that Jamie Foxx is doing it, the way that so many of these supporting people are. Tim Blake Nelson playing another inmate who formerly on death row, who has the possibility to exonerate McMillan. My God, of course, he's perfect in that kind of milieu. And by the way, he's just crushing it on Watchmen on HBO.
Oh, my God. Don't tell me. I got to record it.
But you don't even need to record it. It's available all the time, HBO On Demand, HBO Go. One name in particular, we don't give Oscars or nominations or award nominations for people who only have a couple scenes, unless, of course, it's Judi Dench in Shakespeare in Love, right?
That's 8 minutes.
That's the famous exception. Exactly, right. Exactly. But in a supporting role, I hope I wrote this man's name down, Daryl Britt Gibson. Daryl Britt Gibson is a young actor who plays a young man, a mechanic, who, again, might be able to offer up exonerating testimony, and he's under incredible pressure from both sides. The performance by this young man, Daryl Britt Gibson, is one of the best performances I have seen by any actor in any role, male or female, lead or supporting, this year. It is so good. And I had to look up, where do I know this cat from after this movie? And he is one of Barry's classmates in the acting class in Barry.
Oh, fantastic.
So very much a supporting player in that. But you know, yeah, if he's being put in that ensemble, oh, man, he's got it. He's got it. And in this ensemble, I mean, he just, the screen explodes. You go forward on your seat, riveted by everything this man is doing. Like I said, in just a couple of scenes, it is, if there's any justice in the world, it would be a star-making turn. He is that good. And the name of the movie is Just Mercy. And like I said, I think it comes out in December. A big award hopeful. People love their real-life courtroom dramas, don't they? Mixed bag, like I said. But again, maybe a little bit of a movie maybe we need right now.
Right now. It's the movie we need right now.
So that's it. I mean, I have a lot of other movies on, you know, that we can talk about. Have you seen the Netflix documentary Tell Me Who I Am?
I've seen it on my thing, but I haven't.
It got a lot of acclaim when it came out. It's going to get pushed for Oscar. It's one of these documentaries, Dean. It'd be interesting. I'm not recommending that you see it.
Okay.
It's interesting because the story is so innately compelling. Two identical twin brothers, one of whom suffers a traumatic crash and a head injury and loses his memory entirely.
Oh.
And when he isn't supposed to survive. And when he comes to, he's in a hospital room and he's being stared at by someone he instinctively knows is his brother. It's like looking in a mirror. Of course, he doesn't know that because he hasn't seen a mirror and he doesn't know who he himself is. But he knows when he looks at this person is your brother. You can trust this person.
Okay.
He looks next to him on the bed and there's this woman sobbing, oh my God, my baby's come back, my baby's come back. And seeing that, he turns to his brother and he says, who is this?
Oh.
And of course, it's his mother. So that's how little he knows. He has to relearn everything. Everything. And he trusts his brother, and his brother is his guide. And I think he's in his early 20s when this happens. Maybe high school age. So that's fascinating in and of itself. And then it never occurs to him that the way they live is so strange because his brother tells him how comfortable it all is until the day the truth comes out and the horror of what their life really is. He's confronted by, and yet his brother denies, and he finds out that his brother has been lying about literally everything as he puts back together his memory. So the name of the movie is Tell Me Who I Am. And that story, based on a book by the brothers themselves, but in the movie, for the first time, the brother really fesses up all the details and explains why he never told him. So that sounds great, right? Because the story itself is compelling, but anyone who tells you that this movie is any good is fucking lying. It's fine, but it's not a good movie, and it begs more interesting questions than it ever asks. For every answer it gives, there's a more interesting question to follow up on that is utterly beyond these filmmakers. But they're so taken by the mystery of it, and again, it's such a compelling mystery that on the one hand, yes, watch it because it's fascinating. And so for the first half hour of it, I'm going, well, this is not really very good. And then the second half hour, I'm going, okay, wait, mea culpa, this is great. And then the third half hour, I'm going, well, fuck, why did you do the least with this imaginable? So it's one of those experiences. The story, the underlying story is so great,
right,
but someone telling you the underlying story is infinitely preferable to watching the movie.
Wow, because you made it sound really good. But now you're going to disappoint me when I'll go and watch it and say, well, Phil's rendition of it was so much more entertaining.
You know what else is really disappointing, I must say, and I'm going to throw one of our longtime listeners and good friend to the show and frequent guest, Yoshi Kato, under the bus on this.
Oh, no. What did Yoshi do?
Because he kept asking me, have you seen Spider-Man Far From Home yet? Have you seen Spider-Man Far From Home yet? This is always bad news when someone who knows me well asks me this, because then I feel like I have to do it, and there's some reason intrinsic to me that I need to see this. I remember that being what happened with Zombieland.
Yeah.
Robbie Consing saying to me, of all people, you need to see this. Of all people, you need to see this. And at that point, I remember saying to myself, well, why the fuck? Yeah, I like zombie comedies. Of course, you know, I'm done with zombie movies. But why would he say, of all people, I need to see this? I mean, the only reason I can think of is that Bill Murray would have a cameo in it.
Right.
So sure enough, when Bill Murray has a cameo in it, I'm not surprised, because that's the only reason I could think that anybody would say, I need to see that movie.
Right.
And so I couldn't enjoy it at all as a result.
Right.
So don't tell me that I need to see it. I'll figure it out. Or, like the case of Spider-Man Far From Home, I will develop resentment towards Yoshi for making me, because I ignored everyone else saying that I had to see this.
Right.
And because he told me I had to see it, I sat through the entire running time of what, without a doubt, is the worst fucking superhero movie I've ever seen. It's so god-awful, Spider-Man Far From Home. But then again, are there worse ones? Probably. It's just we're at the point of inundation where, do we need any more? No, we don't need any more. We have Disney Plus. Watch your superhero movies over and over and over again, but don't give me these tortured superhero movies anymore. If you have no reason to tell these stories, why are you telling them? I don't care how much humor you're packing into it or whatever. I'm just, again, can I just go to the marketing department and have them tell me the story?
This is the result of 30 years of San Diego Comic-Con, I'm telling you, that producers and Hollywood filmmakers go down, see how many people? 250,000 people dressed in characters from shows, and then go, holy crap, we gotta capitalize on this. We gotta get in on this action. And now we sit in it. And we sit in it, and like there's no tomorrow, and nobody else has any other idea. It's like being in the 1970s, and all we can think about is disaster movies. Oh, how about the Airport 3? There's a heart attack in the play. Airport 75. Yeah, what about there's a building on fire? You know, we're there. We're there 40 years later.
So for the very last time, we've gone way over time. Say for the last time ever, because honestly, this is going to be a live show, live 9 p.m. Eastern time, Odyssey Radio Network. And we got to stick to it, because we got a 58 and a half minute running time with commercial breaks in the middle. So
there's a robot that sticks commercials in there, for crying out loud.
Really? There's a commercial sticking robot?
Yeah, there's a timer and it goes off and then in comes a commercial.
I'm using that. I am pouncing all over that. and it's not an AI. It's not an AI. It's a robot.
No, it can't figure it. No, you can't reprogram it. It triggers at 58:30, come hell or high water.
Okay. We'll be an hour-long show every week from hereafter, so enjoy this bonus episode, 73. 73, going on 74 minutes of your wow. Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, number 652. And all I can tell people is please like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Instagram as well. That's fun.
Yeah.
But follow us on Twitter, especially twitter.com/DeanAndPhil. Or visit chillpackhollywood.com, chillpakhollywood.com. This show is going to be available many ways, in many different forms. As I understand it, it'll be available on iTunes, but probably not through the same feed as it was before.
Right.
So look for the show on these various sites, because we will point you. We will direct you. What is your phrase about directing the mind on the compass on the infinite?
Infinite? Yes. We set our point on the compass to the infinite of the mind.
I don't know what it was. I don't know. It wasn't
that.
We
have it on t-shirts.
Yeah. We have it on t-shirts, but we can't remember it. Anyway, so please join us when we make this crossover to season two. Because honestly, if you don't listen to us, who will?
Oh my God. That's the t-shirt for season two.
Oh my God. If you don't listen to us, who will? Oh my God. That really is a good ad line. Okay. We are, as they used to say in scripts, ad-libbing till close.
Soft fade out.
Until a fortnight from now, Monday, 9 p.m. Monday. Eastern, Monday, December 2nd. I am Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.